Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Jonathan Safran Foer, who reads from and discusses the paperback version of his acclaimed novel, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, published by Houghton Mifflin. In the weeks to come, we have Anne Lamott, William Haywood Henderson, John Perkins, Rick Riley, Nando Parado, Augustine Burroughs, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it is my pleasure to both welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. We are delighted to welcome Jonathan Safran Foer back to the Tattered Cover to present the paperback edition of his latest novel, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. When I heard the news that Jonathan Safran Foer was coming back to the bookstore, I borrowed a phrase from his highly imaginative character, Oscar, in Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, when I said to myself, that is $100. Please welcome from Jonathan Safran Foer.
I guess the last time I read at the Cherry Hill. Is that the name of the other? Cherry Creek. Bookstore, which was really great. I just had such a wonderful time, and I now know that it's moving sites to a different bookstore, which is going to be an incredible schlep, I can only imagine. But I guess it must be necessary. I'm going to read not too much. This morning I went to East High School, and at a really great time, but the price that I paid for it is I don't feel like I can repeat anything that I said when I was there today, especially because I know that a couple of the students are here. And my greatest fear in life is having somebody is just saying the same thing twice, because I have witnessed people saying the same things twice or three times. I remember I went to a musician I really like is Bright Eyes, and he was playing in New York two consecutive nights, and I went both nights. And the first night I left, I said, what an amazing performance. That was so, just seemed to, really, it was improvisational and energetic. And it was like playing right for me. And I went the second night, and every single aspect was identical. Every last thing, including the, like, offhand remarks, the, like, when he would jump with his guitar. And I left so deflated and so disappointed and upset. And I guess I never want to do that. That having been said, I'm going to read the same thing that I read this morning, which is the beginning of the book. And that's only because it's easy to read the beginning, because it doesn't require any explanation. I think that I'll read on the short side, because my experience as somebody who attends reading is that the reading part is actually a little bit boring, and the question answer is usually a little bit more interesting. Especially if the reader is me, because I'm just not an actor, I'm not a reader, I'm only a writer. I'm a writer in large part because I'm not an actor or a reader. You know, it's like so many of the things that are called upon a writer doing a reading are just antithetical to why the writer wrote in the first place. Like, you know, if your stage presence in life were a little bit greater, there wouldn't be this incredible need to sit at a desk alone and try to, you know, express yourself more slowly. But in any case, so this is the first chapter, and it's narrated by a 9-year-old or an 8-year-old or 10-year-old. It's not exactly clear just how old he is. He tells different people different things. And he's very precocious. He is... all of the things that he loves, all of his eclectic interests are inherited from his father. Like listening to the Beatles, like being a Francophile, you'll hear. So the first chapter is called What The, which is an expression that I have always loved. What The. What about a tea kettle? What, also, I should say that I am very is it mistrustful or distrustful? I never know. But whatever it is, that is how I feel about authors who are very good readers, who are very dramatic. It's like, what is it like? Maybe if you met, I'm not sure. Like if you, there must be some good analogy. Like if you met, I'll think about it as I go, but what about a tea kettle? What if the spout opened and closed when the steam came out so it would become a mouth and it could whistle pretty melodies or do Shakespeare or just crack up with me? I could invent a tea kettle that reads in Dad's voice so I could fall asleep, or maybe a set of kettles that sings the chorus of Yellow Submarine, which is a song by the Beatles, who I love because entomology is one of my raisons d'etre, which is a French expression that I know. Another good thing is that I could train my anus to talk when I farted. If I wanted to be extremely hilarious, I'd train it to say, "Wasn't me," every time I made an incredibly bad one. And if I ever made an incredibly bad fart in the Hall of Mirrors, which is in Versailles, which is outside of Paris, which is in France, obviously, my anus would say, "Ce n'était pas moi." What about little microphones? What if everyone swallowed them and they played the sounds of our hearts through little speakers, which could be in the pouches of our overalls? When you skateboarded down the street at night, you could hear everyone's heartbeat, and they could hear yours, sort of like sonar. Although one weird thing is, I wonder if everyone's hearts would start to beat at the same time, like how women who live together have their menstrual periods at the same time, which I know about but don't really want to know about. That would be so weird, except that the place in the hospital where babies are born would probably sound like a crystal chandelier in a houseboat, because the babies wouldn't have had time to match up their heartbeats yet. And at the finish line, at the end of the New York City Marathon, it would sound like war. So I thought of my analogy, which is when you're in a restaurant, and in the restroom, they draw unusual attention to the fact that their employees wash their hands after they go to the bathroom. And it's one of those things that you think sort of should go without saying, but I think there may be two signs, or the sign is very big, or there's an arrow pointing to the sign, and you start to suspect that maybe they've had a problem with it in the past. That's how I feel about writers who are very good readers. Anyway, my first jiu-jitsu class was 3.5 months ago. Self-defense was something that I was extremely curious about, for obvious reasons, and Mom thought it would be good for me to have a physical activity besides tambourining. So my first jiu-jitsu class was 3.5 months ago. There were 14 kids in the class, and we all had on neat white robes. We practiced bowing, and then we were all sitting down, and then Sensei Mark asked me to go over to him. "Kick my privates," he told me. That made me feel self-conscious. "Excusez-moi," I told him. He spread his legs and told me, "I want you to kick my privates as hard as you can." He put his hands at his sides and took a breath in and closed his eyes, and that's how I knew that he actually meant business. "No way," I told him, and inside I was thinking, "What the?" He told me, "Go on, guy, destroy my privates." "Destroy your privates?" With his eyes still closed, he cracked up a lot and said, "You couldn't destroy my privates if you tried. That's what's going on here. This is a demonstration of the well-trained body's ability to absorb a direct blow. Now, destroy my privates." I told him, "I'm a pacifist." And since most people my age don't even know what that means, I turned around and told the others, "I don't think it's right to destroy people's privates, ever." Sensei Mark said, "Can I ask you something?" I turned back around and told him, "Well, technically, can I ask you something is asking me something." You know, in certain reviews of this book, it was pointed out in a derogatory way that Oscar is an annoying character, as if that weren't intentional. Technically, can I ask you something, is asking me something. He said, "Do you have dreams of becoming a jiu-jitsu master?" "No," I told him. And he said, "Well, do you want to know how a jiu-jitsu student becomes a jiu-jitsu master?" "I want to know everything," I told him. He told me, "A jiu-jitsu student becomes a jiu-jitsu master by destroying his master's privates." very Freudian. I told him, well, that's fascinating. My last jujitsu class was 3.5 months ago. I desperately wish I had my tambourine with me now, because even after everything, I'm still wearing heavy boots, and sometimes it helps to play a good beat. My most impressive song that I can play on my tambourine is The Flight of the Bumblebee by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, which is also the ringtone I downloaded for the cell phone I got after Dad died. It is pretty amazing that I can play The Flight of the Bumblebee, because you have to hit incredibly fast in parts, and that's extremely hard for me because I don't really have fully developed wrists yet. Ron, who is Oscar's mother's boyfriend, so thinks Oscar anyway, Ron offered to buy me a 5-piece drum set. Money can't buy me love, obviously, but I asked if it would have Zildjian cymbals. He said, sure, whatever you want. And then he took my yo-yo off my desk and started to walk the dog with it. I know he just wanted to be friendly, but it made me incredibly angry. Yo-yo moi, I told him, grabbing it back. And what I really wanted to tell him was, you're not my dad, and you never will be. Isn't it so weird, if you think about it, how the number of dead people is increasing, even though the earth stays the same size, so that one day there isn't going to be room to bury anyone anymore? One fascinating thing is that I read in National Geographic that there are more people alive now than have died in all of human history put together. In other words, if everyone wanted to play Hamlet at once, they couldn't, because there aren't enough skulls. So, what about skyscrapers for dead people that were built down? They could be underneath the skyscrapers for living people that are built up. You could bury people 100 floors down, and a whole dead world could be underneath the living world. And sometimes I think it would be weird if there were a skyscraper that moved up and down while its elevator stayed in place. So, if you wanted to go to the 95th floor, you'd just press the 95 button, and the 95th floor would come to you. Also, that could be extremely useful, because if you're on the 95th floor and a plane hits below you, the building could take you to the ground, and everyone could be safe. I've only been in a limousine twice, ever. The first time was terrible, even though the limousine was wonderful. I'm not allowed to watch TV at home, and I'm not allowed to watch TV in limousines either, but it was still neat that there was a TV there. I asked if we could go by school so my friends could see me in a limousine. Mom said school wasn't on the way, and we couldn't be late to the cemetery. Well, why not? I asked, which I actually thought was a good question, because if you think about it, really, why not? Even though I'm not anymore, I used to be an atheist, which means I didn't believe in things that couldn't be observed. I believe that once you're dead forever, and you don't feel anything, and you don't even dream. It's not that I believe in things that can't be observed now, because I don't. It's that I believe that things are extremely complicated. And anyway, it's not like we were actually burying him. Anyway, one kind of funny thing about reading, which happens periodically, is I will see something and then suddenly remember why I got the idea in the first place. I hadn't remembered. I didn't know when I was writing it. I didn't remember when I was editing it, and it didn't make any sense to me until this strange moment. In this case, I guess about 2 years after the fact, when I'll see something and say, oh, I just suddenly remembered. It's like as if you see somebody in a photo and realize that you recognize who that person is. And with this, when it says things are extremely complicated, I was just remembering where that came from, which was a friend in college who had, I guess, a very hard time, an incredibly smart person, just an absolutely brilliant person, probably even a genius, and who I was speaking to one day while this person was having a very hard time, and we just got to talking for whatever reason about religion and belief, and I asked the person if she believed in God, and she said, I believe that things are extremely complicated. And I remember thinking at the time that was the best answer I'd ever heard in my life, and then it reappeared. Even though I was trying hard for it not to, it was annoying me how Grandma kept touching me. So I climbed into the front seat and started poking the driver's shoulder until he gave me some attention. Very explicitly, annoyingly. What is your designation? I asked in Stephen Hawking voice. Say what? He asked. He wants to know your name, Grandma said from the back seat. He handed me his card. I handed him my card. I told him, greetings, Gerald. I am Oscar. He asked me why I was talking like that. I told him, and I will forego using the voice anymore, I told him Oscar's CPU is a neural net processor, a learning computer. The more contact he has with humans, the more he learns. Gerald said, oh, and then he said, okay. I couldn't tell if he liked me or not, so I said, oh, your sunglasses are cool. He said, yeah. I said, do you know a lot of curse words? I know a couple. he said. Well, I'm not allowed to use curse words. Bummer, he said. And I said, what's bummer? He said, it's like a bad thing. And I said, do you know shit? Well, that's a curse, isn't it? He said. And I said, not if you say shit. Taki. Which is my little brother's defense once upon a time when he got busted for saying shit in school. Which made my parents immensely proud. Guess not, Gerald said. And I said, succotash my balzac, dipshitaki. Gerald shook his head and cracked up a lot, but not in the bad way, which is at me. I can't even say hair pie, I told him, unless I'm talking about an actual pie made out of actual rabbits. Cool driving gloves. Yeah, he said. And then I thought of something, so I said it. Actually, if limousines were extremely long, they wouldn't even need drivers. You could just get in the back seat, walk through the limousine, and get out at the front seat, which would be where you wanted to go. So in this situation, the front seat would be at the cemetery. And I would be watching the game right now, he said. I patted his shoulder and told him, when you look up hilarious in the dictionary, there's a picture of you. In the back seat, Mom was holding something in her purse. I could tell she was squeezing it because I could see her arm muscles. Grandma was knitting white mittens, and I knew they were for me, even though it wasn't cold out. I wanted to ask Mom what she was squeezing and why she had to keep it hidden. I remember thinking that even if I were suffering hypothermia, I would never, ever put on those mittens. Now that I'm thinking about it, I told Gerald, they could make an incredibly long limousine that had its back seat at your mom's VJ and its front seat at your grave, and it would be exactly as long as your life. Gerald said, true, but if everyone lived like that, no one would ever meet anyone, right? And I said, so what? I crawled back because it's dangerous to drive and talk at the same time, especially on the highway, which is what we were on. Grandma started touching me again, which was annoying, even though I didn't want it to be. I looked up at the limousine sunroof, and I imagined the world before there were ceilings, which made me wonder, does a cave technically have no ceiling, or is a cave technically all ceiling? Mom? Yes? I have a question. Okay. What are you squeezing in your purse? She pulled out her hand and opened it, and it was empty. Just squeezing, she said. Even though it was an incredibly sad day, she really looked very beautiful, and I kept trying to figure out a way to tell her that, but all the ways I thought of were weird and wrong. She was wearing the bracelet that I made for her, and that made me feel like $100. I love making jewelry for her because it makes her happy, and making her happy is another one of my raisons d'etre. It isn't anymore, but for a really long time, it was my dream to take over the family jewelry business. Dad constantly used to tell me I was too smart for retail. Well, that never made any sense to me because he was smarter than me, so if I was too smart for retail, then he really must have been too smart for retail. I told him that. First of all, he said, I'm not smarter than you. I'm more knowledgeable than you, and that's only because I'm older than you. Parents are always more knowledgeable than their children, and children are always smarter than their parents. Well, unless the child's a mental retard, I told him. He didn't have anything to say about that. When I wrote that line, or maybe it was when, actually, my wife became pregnant and I realized I had written that line, I suddenly became very afraid that that had, in some cosmic way, cursed me to having a mentally retarded child. Not that that is a bad thing, just that I thought, I suddenly, like, all of the jokes that I had made at other people's expense caught up to me. And it really made me really very nervous. I probably wouldn't write such a thing anymore. So you said, first of all, what's second of all? Second of all, he said, if I'm so smart, then why am I in retail? Well, that's true, I said. And then I thought of something. But hey, Dad, wait a minute. It won't be the family jewelry business if no one in the family is running it. And he told me, well, sure it will. It'll just be someone else's family. I asked, well, what about our family? Are we going to open a new business? And he said, we'll open something. I thought about that my second time in a limousine when we were on the way to dig up his empty grave, his empty coffin. A great game that Dad and I would sometimes play on Sundays was Reconnaissance Expedition, and now this reading is really winding down. Sometimes the reconnaissance expeditions were extremely simple, like when he told me to bring back something from every decade in the 20th century. I was very clever and just brought back a rock. And sometimes they were incredibly complicated and would go on for a couple of weeks. For the last one we ever did, which never finished, he gave me a map of Central Park. I said, and? And he said, and what? I said, well, what are the clues? He said, who said there had to be clues? Well, there are always clues. That doesn't in itself suggest anything, Oscar. Not a single clue. And he said, unless no clues is a clue. And I asked him, well, is no clues a clue? He shrugged his shoulders like he had absolutely no idea what in the world I was talking about, and I loved that. I spent all day walking around the park looking for something that might tell me something, but the problem was I didn't know what I was looking for. I went up to people and asked if they knew anything I should know, because sometimes Dad would design reconnaissance expeditions so that I'd have to talk to people. But everyone I went up to was just like, what the? I looked for clues around the reservoir. I read every poster on every lamppost and tree. I inspected the descriptions of the animals at the zoo. I even made kite flyers reel in their kites so that I could examine them, although I knew it was improbable. But that's how tricky Dad could be. That night we ordered Chinese for dinner, and I noticed that Dad was using a fork, even though he was perfect with chopsticks. Hey, wait a minute, I said. And I stood up, and I pointed at his fork. Is that fork a clue? He shrugged his shoulders, which to me meant, this fork is a major clue. So I started thinking about forks. I ran to my laboratory and got my metal detector out of its box in the closet. Because I'm not allowed to be alone in the park at night, Grandma went with me. I started at the 86th Street entrance and walked in extremely precise lines, like I was one of the Mexican guys who mow the lawn, so I wouldn't miss anything. It even occurred to me I would have a Mexican son when I thought about that, which would have been wonderful in its own way. I knew the insects were loud because it was summer, but I didn't hear them because my earphones covered my ears. It was just me and the metal underground. Every time the beeps would get close together, I'd tell Grandma to shine the flashlight on the spot. Then I'd put on my white gloves, take the hand shovel from my kit, and dig extremely gently. When I saw something, I used a paintbrush to get rid of the dirt, just like a real archaeologist. Even though I searched only a small area of the park that night, I dug up a quarter and a handful of paper clips and what I thought was the chain from a lamp that you pull to make the light go on, and a refrigerator magnet for sushi, which I know about but wish I didn't. I put all the evidence in a bag and marked on a map of Central Park where I'd found it. When I got home, I examined the evidence in my laboratory under my microscope one piece at a time. A bent spoon, some screws, a pair of rusty scissors, a toy car, a key ring, broken glasses for somebody with incredibly bad eyes. I brought them to Dad, who was reading the New York Times at the kitchen table, marking the mistakes with his red pen. Here's what I found, I said, showing him the tray of evidence. He looked at it and nodded. I asked, well, so? He shrugged his shoulders like he had no idea what he was talking about, what I was talking about. And he went back to the paper. Well, can't you even tell me if I'm on the right track? He shrugged his shoulders again. But if you don't tell me anything, how can I ever be right? He circled something in an article and said, another way of looking at it, Oscar, would be how could you ever be wrong? He got up to get a drink of water, and I examined what he'd circled on the page because that's how tricky he could be. It was in an article about the girl who had disappeared and how everyone thought the congressman who was humping her, Gary Condit, if anybody remembers him, had killed her. A few months later, they found her body in Rock Creek Park, which is in Washington, D.C., but by then everything was different and no one cared anymore, well, except for her parents. And in the article, what he circled were the words, not stop looking. It wasn't a mistake. It was a message to me. So I went back to the park every night for the next 3 nights. I dug up a hair clip and a roll of pennies and a thumbtack and a coat hanger and a 9-volt battery and a Swiss Army knife and a tiny picture frame and a tag for a dog named Turbo and a square of aluminum foil and a ring and a razor and an extremely old pocket watch that was stopped at 5:37, although I didn't know if it was a.m. or p.m. But I still couldn't figure out what it all meant. The more I found, the less I understood. I spread the map of Central Park out on the dining room table and held down the corners with glasses of water. The dots from where I'd found things looked like the stars in the universe, and I connected them like an astrologer, and if you squinted your eyes like a Chinese person, it kind of looked like the word fragile. Fragile. So I thought, well, what was fragile? Was Central Park fragile? Was nature fragile? Were the things that I found fragile? A thumbtack isn't really fragile. Is a bent spoon fragile? I erased and I connected the dots in a different way to make door. Fragile door. And then I thought of port, which is French for door, obviously. So I erased and I connected the dots to make that. And I had the revelation that I could connect the dots to make cyborg and platypus and boobs and even Oscar, if you were extremely Chinese. I could connect them to make almost anything I wanted, which meant I wasn't getting any closer to anything, and now I'll never know what I was supposed to find. And that's another reason I can't sleep. Well, anyway. A few weeks after the worst day, I started writing lots of letters. I don't know why, but it was one of the only things that made my boots lighter. One weird thing is instead of using normal stamps, I used stamps for my collection, including valuable ones, which sometimes made me wonder if what I was really doing was trying to get rid of things. The first letter I wrote was to Stephen Hawking. I used a stamp of Alexander Graham Bell. Do Dear Stephen Hawking, can I please be your protege? Thanks, Oscar Schell. I thought he wasn't going to respond because he was such an amazing person and I was so normal. But then one day I came home from school and Stan, the doorman, handed me an envelope. And I ran up the 105 stairs to the apartment and ran to my laboratory and went into my closet and turned on my flashlight and opened the letter. The letter inside was typed, obviously, because Stephen Hawking has amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, unfortunately. Thank you for your letter. Because of the large volume of mail I receive, I'm unable to write personal responses. Nevertheless, know that I read and save every letter with the hope of one day being able to give each the proper response it deserves. Until that day, most sincerely, Stephen Hawking. Anyway, Dad always used to tuck me in and he'd tell the greatest stories and we'd read the New York Times together. One thing that was so great was how we could find a mistake in every single article we looked at, which is a kind of interesting challenge if any of you are bored one day, because you can really find a mistake in every single article. Sometimes they were grammar mistakes, sometimes they were mistakes with geography or facts, and sometimes the article just didn't tell the whole story. I loved having a dad who was smarter than the New York Times, and I loved how my cheek could feel the hairs on his chest through his t-shirt and how he always smelled like shaving even at the end of the day. Being with him made my brain quiet. I didn't have to invent anything. When Dad was tucking me in that night, this is the night before the worst day, I asked him if the world is a flat plate supported on the back of a giant tortoise, because that's from a hilarious story on the first page of A Brief History of Time. Excuse me? Well, it's just that, you know, why does the earth stay in place instead of falling through the universe? He said, is this Oscar I'm tucking in? Has an alien stolen his brain for experimentation? I said, we don't believe in aliens. And he said, the earth does fall through the universe. You know that, buddy. It's constantly falling toward the sun. That's what it means to orbit. And I said, obviously, but why is there gravity? And he said, that's a question I don't understand. What do you mean, why is there gravity? And I said, well, what's the reason? He said, who said there had to be a reason? Well, because if there isn't a reason, then why does the universe exist at all? Because of sympathetic conditions. So then why am I your son at all? Well, because Mom and I made love and one of my sperm fertilized one of her eggs. Excuse me while I regurgitate. Well, what I don't get is why do we exist? I don't mean how, but why? And he said, we exist because we exist. That's the best answer. And I said, what the? And he said, we could imagine all sorts of universes unlike this one, but this is the one that happened. I understood what he meant, and I didn't disagree with him, but I didn't agree with him either. Just because you're an atheist, that doesn't mean you wouldn't love for things to have reasons for why they are. I turned on my shortwave radio, and with Dad's help, I was able to pick up someone speaking Greek, which was nice. We couldn't understand what he was saying, but we lay there, looking at the glow-in-the-dark constellations on my ceiling, and listened for a while. The front page was spread over us like a blanket. There was a picture of a tennis player on his back, who I guess was the winner, although it was hard to tell if he was happy or sad. The moment before Dad started the story was my favorite. And when the story finished, we turned the radio back on and found someone speaking French, which was especially nice. Dad asked if I was still awake, and I didn't answer because I knew he didn't like to leave until I had fallen asleep, and I didn't want him to be tired for work in the morning. He kissed my forehead and said goodnight, and then he was at the door. Dad? Yeah, buddy? And I said, well, nothing. The next time I heard his voice was when I came home from school the next day. We were let out early because of what had happened. I wasn't even a little bit panicky because both Mom and Dad worked in Midtown and Grandma didn't work, obviously. So maybe it's an emergency, actually. Whenever it rings twice, that's when you have to pick up. Absolutely, regardless of where you are. I mean, what if, God forbid? I wasn't even a little bit panicky because both Mom and Dad worked in Midtown and Grandma didn't work, obviously, so everybody that I loved was safe. I know that it was 10:18 when I got home because I look at my watch a lot. The apartment was so empty and so quiet. As I walked to the kitchen, I invented a lever that could be on the front door, which would trigger a huge spoked wheel in the living room to turn against metal teeth that would hang down from the ceiling so that it would play beautiful music, like maybe Fixing a Hole or I Want to Tell You, and the apartment would be one huge music box. I pet the cat for a few seconds to show him I loved him, and I checked the phone messages. I didn't have a cell phone yet, and when we were leaving school, my friend told me he'd call to let me know what we were going to do with the day off. Message 1, Tuesday, 8:52 a.m. Is anybody there? Hello, it's Dad. If you're there, pick up. Pick up now. I just tried the office, but no one was picking up. Listen, something's happened. I'm okay. They're telling us to stay where we are and wait for the firemen I'm sure it's fine. I'll give you another call when I have a better idea of what's going on. Just wanted to let you know that I'm okay. So you really don't have to worry. No reason to worry. I'm okay. I'll call again soon. There were four more messages from him. One at 9:12, one at 9:31, one at 9:46, and one at 10:04. I listened to them. I listened to them again. And then, before I had time to figure out what to do, or even what to think or feel, the phone started ringing. It was 10:22 and 27 seconds. I looked at the caller ID and saw that it was him. So I'll stop there. That was even more than I intended to read in the first place. And hopefully, maybe people have questions or something to start a conversation. Where was I? I was in Queens in Jackson Heights. It's where I used to live. I've just been out of the country, actually, for about 3 months. And I came back, I think, on September 8th or so. And I was so excited to be home, just really excited. You know that feeling when you're watching a movie and you see your neighborhood and it's like the greatest thrill on earth? For whatever reason, it's just so exhilarating. Like, the place I live is now famous. That was the feeling I had on September 8th when I came home. Just everything felt elevated. And I was like, the Chinese restaurant where I used to get food felt famous. And, you know, the mailman felt famous. Everything felt elevated and wonderful. And I was so, as like, there's nothing can make you feel more at home than being away from home. And then this happened on September 11th, and I was actually asleep when the first plane went in, and I got a phone call from a friend who said, you really should turn on the TV. This thing has happened. And I said, okay, yes, I'll get out of bed. And I remember he said, I think today is going to be a really strange day. And I spent the next 24 hours watching TV, basically. And so in that sense, my experience is probably not very different from somebody who was in Denver or somebody who was in Iceland or in Australia, for that matter. And it's one of the really, I guess you could say interesting, or you could say moving. I'm not really sure what the right adjective is, but it's one of the central things about the event is we were all, in a way, except for people who are downtown, we were all sort of equal distance, you know. I think it was the first truly global event. It was the most visually documented event in human history. So nothing has ever been seen by as many people as that was, which in itself is such an interesting or moving fact. And so the next day I went down to Lower Manhattan. It was still totally chaotic, and they'd set up roadblocks, but you could find ways through, and everything was covered in dust, and there were already posters up. And it was really like walking around in a dream. I think everybody felt that way. There was something palpably surreal. Just how quiet the city was, how unambitious it was. That might be a strange word to use, but when you walk around New York, you're so used to people being in a hurry and people having something to do. You know, money to make or elections to win or people to screw, literally or out of something. And it just wasn't like that. Everybody was pausing. He asked, I forgot, I'm supposed to repeat the questions. He asked, when it occurred to me to write about September 11th, was I hesitant? Is that what you said? Did I hesitate? It never occurred to me to write about September 11th. The thing that occurred to me was that I should never write about September 11th. I remember, actually, that my first book came out not that long afterward, and I was in a bookstore. And I think one of the first things I said was, I know a lot of writers who are writing about September 11th, and I will never write about September 11th. None of them ended up writing about it, and I did. I was working on a very different book about this German who kept a diary in like the 40s and then disappeared. The diary became very famous. A museum was created around his life, and then he reappears 50 or 60 years later in this museum. So it couldn't have been more different from this book. But I never put that book down to write a different book. As far as I'm concerned, I finished that book. It's just that it changed. All of these images started coming into it, like birds, things having to do with flight. And then birds became airplanes. And I was really, for whatever reason, really interested in or found myself writing a lot about walls and buildings. And the buildings became skyscrapers. It was like one step at a time I was moving toward writing about September 11th. Totally unconsciously. It's like there's this old philosophical parable or riddle, I guess, about if you leave a harbor in a boat, and in the course of the journey you replace every single plank of the boat, when you get to the destination, would you say that you are arriving in the same boat that you departed in? On the one hand, well, no, because what's a boat if not everything that makes up the boat? On the other hand, how do I explain that I got from there to here if I wasn't on the same boat? And that's how I feel about the book. I replaced every single word, although I really never put it down. I felt like I must be the same book. So I didn't even realize what I was doing until I showed the book to my little brother and a draft of it. And he said, well, it really seems like you're writing around September 11th. At this point, there was this young boy who had all these anxieties about skyscrapers and flight and terrorism. But his father died of a heart attack. And my little brother said, well, why does he die of a heart attack? Why, you know, it seems like maybe you're gesturing toward this other thing. And it was like it never occurred to me, strangely, or I was trying so hard to resist it that I forced it not to occur to me. And then once he said it, I knew it was true, and that, you know, I'm much more afraid of writing, of not writing something that I should be writing than I am of failing at something that I write, if that makes sense. There's this idea in the world right now that, and you can see it everywhere, that like a bad book is as bad as a good book is good, as if a bad book were negative one and a good book were positive one. Like the New York Times Book Review will have on its cover bad reviews, as they did of my book, as if that were as important as a good review, you know? And it's such a silly idea, because like a failed book is not that big a deal. It just disappears. Like, it's bad for the author, but it's not that bad for the world. I've never heard of a kid starving because of a bad book. Maybe the child of the author, but not somebody halfway around the world. But a good book is so good. I mean, a good book actually can change the world. I guess I still believe that. It can make people see things differently. It can make politicians act differently. It can make people lead their lives differently. A bad book is minus 0.001, and a good book is plus 100 million. And if it takes 100 million bad books to make a good book, that's a pretty small price to pay. As it turns out, that is about how many it takes. I mean, it's not. I don't say that as a joke. If you think about it, I don't know the statistic, but 1,000 books are published in America every day? 10,000? I don't know what it is. It's a lot of books. And, you know, this is a huge bookstore we're in, but it's a bookstore of finite space. It's not getting any bigger. So books are constantly being taken off the shelf. And I figure if my book gets taken off the shelf, it's not the end of the world. But if I don't write the thing that I feel like I somehow should be writing, that is a kind of end of the world, or it is for me. Or at the very least, I should stop doing what I'm doing and do something else. So he asked, in the scenes of war that are both pretty graphic and also pretty, I don't know, they're more of a realistic quality than a lot of the other things in both books, and they're both narrated in a first-person way. Where did that come from? So I almost never research. I actively dislike research, because it's so constraining. You know, once you read a fact, particularly a historical fact, it's just hard to ignore, you know? It's one of the reasons why I don't always like to answer questions as an author, because the answers that authors give are very hard to ignore once you've heard them. You know, if I tell you Oscar is 12, you will think Oscar is 12. I mean, it's going to be hard to disagree with me, which is a shame, because I don't know the truth any more than anybody else does. That's not what, you know, books have this kind of fluidity. That's what's good about books, is that they don't belong to anybody. Their meaning doesn't belong to anybody. Anyway, in the case of those two passages, I did do a little bit of research, not because I was trying to get it historically correct, but because I suspected that in these cases, the truth would actually be more interesting and more vivid than anything I could imagine. And in the case of the Dresden firebombing, I went to lots of first-person accounts. And just something that crept up in the corners of a lot of them was that the zoo was bombed, and a whole lot of them for some reason, and that like different animals would appear in different people's accounts. And I just thought that was one of the most horrific details I'd ever read. And it got at the brutality and the physicality of war. I think now, in particular, we're so used to thinking of war as an idea, or as this abstract thing that happens with smart bombs that go down the right chimneys and kill the right person, and there's kind of no blood at the end of the day. But in fact, it's like blood and guts, and it's these things that are so horrible that if we were to ever see them ourselves, we would work a lot harder at making sure they didn't happen. It's one of the reasons why, and I am always surprised when I think this, but I've been thinking it pretty consistently for a while now, that maybe we should have a draft, because so many of us are so alienated or so distanced from that physical reality of what's happening, that it's relatively easy not to worry about it. You know, it's easy not to be hysterical about it. A lot of people are upset about it. A lot of people vote against it when there's the opportunity to. But very few people are hysterical about it. But I have a feeling if I were there, and if I were witnessing this, and if I were contributing to it, I would be hysterical. So when I saw that this business about the zoo, I thought it could bring out something that was true about the physicality. But also it was an opportunity, weirdly, to make the victim the perpetrator. You know, this person who is a citizen, an entirely innocent citizen of Dresden, who is being bombed, suddenly is a person holding the gun, shooting these animals. And it struck me as being very powerful. And it's something that I wouldn't have come up with. Yes, how do I feel about the film version of Everything's Illuminated? It's like asking a father if he thinks his daughter looks sexy on prom night, you know? There's not really a good answer. I didn't have anything to do with the making of it. It was very much somebody else's doing. And I actually went to see the movie in a movie theater, just like anybody else. I went, whatever it was, a Saturday or Sunday afternoon with a couple friends. There were two other people in the theater. And so I was hoping to go and gauge how good the movie was by people's reaction. So there are two people in the theater, which is not a wide sampling. One of them left the movie about halfway in. The other person was laughing hysterically and just loving it. So it was either good or bad. I don't know which. But all I can say is I found it very difficult to watch and very awkward. It made me feel very awkward. It was kind of like, it was just awkward. It was like seeing somebody impersonate you, you know? It was exactly that awkward and a little bit humiliating, but also a little bit fun. And I would not have made the same movie, but I'm not a filmmaker. I wouldn't have made any movie. So some of the choices I found puzzling. Some of them I found interesting. And, you know, life moves on. I was excellent as the leaf blower. So it's funny. So they were filming the movie in Prague. I happened to be very close by because I was interviewing the number one ping pong player in the world. I actually got to play with him. And so I was so nearby that I thought, this is really foolish not to go to the set. So I went to the set, and I walked around, and like, obviously nobody knew who I was. It was just somebody else who was there. And I heard all, you know, there's like, movies are not like books. Books are like, you're in bed and you're writing with a laptop propped up, you know, on a pillow. Movies are like, there's 500 people doing everything at once, and people are yelling. And I got there, and all the commotion, and people are saying, all right, we need the younger Jonathan and Jonathan's grandmother. We need to go to Jonathan's room. Everybody, pronto. And I was like, what? What's going on here? And there's a little kid, if you've seen the movie, who is sort of dressed to look like a version of me, I guess. And it was very, very surreal. And anyway, Liev, who was the screenwriter and director, had it in mind that it would be fun for me to make a little appearance. I now realize that, in a way, it was very smart of him, because it's hard to comment on a movie that you're in. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's hard to... I was suddenly complicit in this movie in a way that I might not have been. But so my singular task was to walk across a screen holding a leaf blower outfit. And I was actually really excited. I thought it was going to be really fun. And, you know, thousands of people in it. I thought, like, all this catering for me, that's not necessary. I'm just walking across a screen with a leaf blower. And, okay, everybody's ready. Put on makeup. Get me in this outfit. Action. Walk across the screen. "Cut, cut, cut. What did I do wrong? You gotta stop smiling," he said. And we tried it again. Action went across. "Cut, cut, cut. You've got to stop smiling." And I said, "I'm just not smiling. I don't know what to say. I know I'm not a Shakespearean actor, but I know that I'm not smiling." And I guess I found it so funny and weird that I couldn't stop smiling. So it was originally going to be a closer shot, and that's quite a distant shot. Does anybody else have any questions? Did I ever write to that reviewer? You could be speaking of two different reviewers, actually. She asked if I ever wrote to the reviewer in the New York Times. Oh, I didn't actually read the review, to be honest. I know enough about it that I know what you're now talking about. No, there is no reason to write. First of all, he's perfectly entitled to his idiotic opinion. But secondly, I wouldn't say I didn't care, because that's just not true. You know, I did care. And it's not fun at all to be so publicly derided. On the other hand, he would really... It's not a competition, but if it were, he would win if I wrote him a letter. You know what I mean? Like, it's just over, you know? And it's the same thing with good reviews, bad reviews, indifferent reviews. It's all over the second it's done, and you hope that what you write, you know, isn't over. But it's not the meanest thing anybody's ever written about me. It's not even in the top 10. So, yeah. But... you know, we know where people like that go, ultimately. I've never met a happy person who is also so angry. Do you know what I mean? Like, I wonder if anybody has written a really vitriolic review who is perfectly happy in his career or in his life. And I don't know. It just wasn't... You know, I've already said way too much. He's probably already won just from all these answers. I think it's time for one or two more. Or what was my inspiration for Alex and Everything is Illuminated? I don't think I've ever once in my life been inspired. It's a word that I don't even understand when people say, "What was your inspiration?" or "I feel inspired." I just don't have that. And you know, a question that I'm sometimes asked when I go to high schools, I go to a lot of high schools to do readings, is, "Do you write with a pen or a pencil or a laptop?" And it's a very peculiar question, because who cares? You know, it's so unimportant. It's so mundane. On the other hand, I think it's a pretty good question, because it gets at, I think what is really being asked is, what happens when somebody writes? Like, what separates you, who I recognize as a writer, from me, who is not a writer? Maybe it's something in the process of how you do it. Maybe there's some kind of magic or something that happens, and there isn't any magic, you know, at all. And there's nothing like a muse. There's nothing like inspiration. As I said at this high school actually this morning, I find writing to be just incredibly frustrating and difficult, not pleasant. I know somebody who said writing is like pulling teeth out of your penis. It's about that much fun. But the interesting thing is, once you remove any of those funny ideas about it being a magical, inspiring experience, it actually then can become a magical, inspiring experience, because it's something that's informed by will, you know, that I choose to sit down to do this, despite how hard it is, despite how frustrated I am, despite how impossible the task always seems. You choose to do it, and you choose to make these incredibly small incremental gains, not these heroic gestures, but you leave and you are okay if you've written a couple of sentences that feel okay, that feel acceptable. And so when I was writing Alex, it wasn't that I had this great idea at some point, it was that I don't remember exactly how it started, but I know it was like a series of little accidents. Like, maybe I was doing a thesaurus function on Word, and I picked a strange word by accident, and it came up. Or maybe I made a typo. I don't remember. I didn't intend to create somebody who spoke like that at first. Somehow, though, it started to be interesting to me. It's like people who see Jesus in mold on bread, you know? It wasn't supposed to be that way, but once you see it, it can become really special. And and that's how it was, and that's how it always is in everything that I do. I don't have real intentions when I start to write. It's that the accidents are fortuitous if you let them be. One of my favorite lines is Joseph Brodsky said, "The rhyme is smarter than the poet." And it's like a real principle that I live by, that I don't trust my intuitions, I don't trust my abilities, but I do trust accidents to be somebody who recognizes them when they happen. Technically the person behind you, but now I have to explain why I would pick the person behind you instead of you, but go ahead. Both of you, and then that will be enough. Right. So the gist of that question, which is a very nice question, was I wrote about parenthood in a way before I was a parent, and how do I feel about it now that I am a parent? And also, why would I write in certain ways without being a parent, or how did I know certain things maybe about being a parent? Writing depends on knowing things that haven't happened to you. First of all, I really believe that we just do know certain things evolutionarily. It's like spun into us. I remember the first time I had sex, you'll forgive me, with another person, I mean. The thought that I had that was most strong was, this is precisely what it was like in my dreams. That it's like as it was as if it wasn't even necessary to have it, because the information was so accurate in my head in advance. It sounds like a funny thing to say, but I believe the information was just there. It was spun inside of me. And a lot of things about parenthood were spun inside of me before I had a child. It's like, I guess it's evolution's way of preparing you. You know, the things that you have to know. It's just in the same way that a child has to know how to feed before it's ever fed. But also, we make these like empathic leaps when you write, that you make the effort to know things that haven't happened to you or couldn't happen to you. And readers make the exact same leap. You know, the things you read about are almost never things that have actually happened to you, but you have to find a way to relate to them, to know if they feel authentic or not. You're relying on senses that aren't informed by your experience. And that's the most wonderful thing about writing, and it's something to have, you know, great faith in, that we could know things about people whose lives are unlike ours. It's something that we depend on every day, but particularly now in the world, you know, that there's something I have in common with somebody living in Baghdad, let's say. And there's an awful lot that separates us circumstantially, but somehow wired, coiled into us is a lot of the same information. We can respond. If we had the vehicles to, if there were things between us, we would probably find a way to relate across them. And it's such a shame that this is another thing I was talking about at the high school this morning. Something I feel very strongly, or carried, I guess, deeply about, is that, you know, art plays absolutely no role in our relationship with the Arab world right now. Just absolutely no role whatsoever. However many troops we've sent, 100,000, 150,000, however many diplomats we've sent, we haven't sent any translators, you know, of literature. We haven't sent any curators. In the high school this morning, I asked how many students had read anything translated from Arabic ever. And I think maybe one or two students raised their hands. And I assume the answer would, you know, the response would be more or less the same in this room. And it's, if you just think about that for a second, it's a very scary fact, because one of my favorite poets is a Polish poet named Zbigniew Herbert. And he said that imagination is the instrument of compassion. And it's something that I believe, that one of the things that the imagination can do is help us to relate in that, like, fundamental way, where we share the things that are coiled inside of us, like that comes before, what color your skin is, or what religion you practice, or in what country you live, what language you speak, what your gender is. And it does it better than anything else. It does it better than nonfiction. It does it better than politics. It does it better than psychology. It does it better than anything. You know, storytelling does. And we have devalued it to such an extent that we are suspicious of it. You know, why is it that so many people asked me, is it too early to write about September 11th? You know, did anybody ask Tom Brokaw when it was September 11th if it was too early to broadcast about September 11th? Of course not. Were there risks when he broadcast? Of course. He made so many mistakes. If you go back and look at the newspapers or the television reels, it's actually shocking, and you know, how wrong they were, how factually inaccurate. And when a journalist is inaccurate, then there really are ramifications. Like, we went to war in Iraq in no small part because of journalistic mistakes. You know, journalists who weren't doing their full duty to uncover the truth. And when a writer makes a mistake, as I said before, it doesn't lead us to war. And yet, we are so much more suspicious of writers than we are of journalists. Do we think that, like, Wolf Blitzer is smarter than Philip Roth? Do we think he's a more ethical person? Possibly. Do we think that he is better at articulating what he wants to articulate? Of course not. I think Philip Roth has everything that Wolf Blitzer or anybody else has. So why do we trust Wolf Blitzer's story so much more? Somebody who is selling commercials, you know, in between his broadcasts, somebody who has a career to pursue himself, somebody who's part of a massive corporation. There are all these reasons we shouldn't trust his story as much, and yet we do. So I guess I just wish that art and storytelling were a bigger part of, like, the American conversation, and particularly the American conversation with the Arab world. And this would be the last question. So she'd read an interview where the interviewer asked if I fancied myself a writer, and how do I feel about that? Well, fancy is a truly horrible word, isn't it? You fancy yourself a landscaper or a designer of pinky rings, maybe. But do I think of myself as a writer? Do I consider myself a writer? I probably said no then, because I didn't feel like I had... Maybe I didn't feel like I had earned it yet, or I didn't feel like I was certain of it yet. I didn't want to be constrained by that, you know. And I guess I would answer, I have a lot of the same feelings, you know, that technically I am a writer. There's no getting around that. It's my profession. It's what I do. And it's what I'm going to do for at least a little while. But maybe this comes back to that thing about the magic and the will, and how much more I care about the will than the magic. Part of the will is the feeling that you choose to do it every day. And it's not a foregone conclusion that you'll write another book or write another word, that it's a decision that you make every day. And that is still how I feel, that every day I'm somebody who becomes a writer. You know, it's not something that I wake up with. It's something that happens when I turn on my computer and start to work. I don't know if it's what I'll always do. There are a lot of times when I feel like I don't want to do it anymore, that I've become too familiar with how I write, and it's not, now I'm just a carpenter, sort of, or I don't surprise myself enough, or I'm just more interested in other things than I am in writing. And that's maybe 99% of the time, actually, that I feel that way, that it's not what I want to do. But then that 1% of the time is so great, and it really retroactively justifies everything. You know, the moment when you say, this isn't nonsense, this isn't dribble, this is exactly what I wanted to say. Somebody had asked me just recently how you would define yourself, which is in a way a similar question. And what I said is, my books are how I would define myself. This is precisely how I would define myself, even though I'm not like the characters, even though the things that happen in the books haven't happened to me. The thing that I like about writing is that it gives me an opportunity to define myself that I don't have in my non-writing life, and I haven't found any other way to do it. So until I find a better way to do it, or until it becomes unimportant to me to define myself, this will be what I continue to do. So thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodum. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Anne Lamott, William Haywood Henderson, John Perkins, Rick Riley, Nando Parado, Augustine Burroughs, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on April 3rd, 2006.